All right. Well, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us today. And it's been a while, been a little bit, but we've got an interview, and it's one that I'm really pumped and excited to bring to you guys today. It's a guy that I have been reading for quite a while. Interesting to finally get a chance to talk to him. And one of those interviews where you just it kind of catches you off guard because you go, you know, I never really thought I'd be having a conversation with this guy. But then reading his stuff was part of my journey, part of me getting to where I am. And he was a source of information for me and a source of confirmation for what I was seeing. And he's been a prominent voice in financial media for quite a while. I'll say financial alternative media. But anyway, without further ado, that special guest with us today is Mike Krieger of LibertyBlitzkrieg.com. It's been a great source of information for me. So first of all, I would recommend that you check out his website, LibertyBlitzkrieg.com, and then on Twitter at LibertyBlitz. So Mike, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, Zach. It's great to be on your show. I don't go on, you know, financially focused stuff as much anymore because it's not, you know, it doesn't consume my life like it used to. So it'll be fun, you know, to talk to a different audience or a more financially focused audience. So thanks for having me on.
Oh, you bet. I'm assuming you would agree. I think to be truly, truly financially focused, I see you as being truly financially focused. It may not jive with CNBC's definition of financially focused, but it sure jives with mine. And first and foremost, you're not just a guy howling on the internet. I want the readers to understand your background. You went to Duke, studied economics. You got hired by Lehman Brothers as a oil and gas analyst. Then you went to Sanford C. Bernstein on Wall Street, a prominent and respected Wall Street firm. You started writing there, and you had a heck of a career going on in Wall Street. And then, surprising, to so many of the people out there chasing the carrot, then you decided to leave. So let's start there, Mike. I don't have time, but there's so much good stuff that you've done on the internet. People can find the whole story, but give us an abridged rundown of where you're at today and how you got there and why you'd walk away from a really promising career on Wall Street that had a ton of momentum.
That's all correct, and it's a strange journey. I think 99.9% of people in my shoes would definitely not have left, and probably if I hadn't left, life would have been easier, but not as interesting, and I would certainly be a lot less happy, I believe, and content, versus where I am. But it was a crazy choice. But to give you from a conventional standpoint, that is. But to give you a little background, so I'm a New York City kid originally. That's where I grew up, in the heart of Manhattan. Went to Duke, as you said. I really didn't have much of a, I wasn't that thoughtful at the time, and I guess a lot of 18, 19-year-olds aren't. But about the world and what I wanted and meaning and purpose and all that. I just wanted to sort of enjoy life and, whatever. And so I sort of stumbled my way into Wall Street. I did like markets. I always had that sort of, the way my mind works is a macro, is from just works macro, always has, big picture. But I also really love the idea that every day you wake up and there's a million things to look at and a million new sources of information to consume and then apply that in a sort of a very, P&L way to in real life, which the markets allowed. So I was always fascinated by it, but I wasn't one of these guys, and there were a lot of them at Duke that spent 4 years saying, I'm going to go to Wall Street. I'm going to spend these 4 years trying to get to Wall Street. I didn't do that, but I did major in economics. And then when I was going into Wall Street, it was the biggest class ever, pretty much. It was 2000. I literally started in July of 2000. So they hired a lot of people, which is probably how I snuck in there in the first place. But anyway, I ended up at Lehman Brothers, as you said, equity research. I did 5 years, in the models. I was in a cubicle, basically dug into a model for 12, 13 hours a day. And I did that for 5 years, at which point I had enough of that. and moved on to Sanford C. Bernstein, as you said, which is a, you know, very much a research-driven firm. That's what they do. They just do really deep dives on industries and companies. And there I was a commodities desk analyst. I really sat on the trading desk analyzing the whole space and helping to sell the research analysts' material as well. And it was there that towards the end, I mean, as you say, you know, my career, when I left Bernstein, when I resigned, I was at the top of my game. I mean, I was making a ton of money for you know, someone that age, 30, 31 years old. And, you know, I had a huge bright future ahead of me in a conventional sense. But when the financial crisis hit and I saw the response to it, all right, and I saw that all of the nation's resources were being geared to saving people like me, who were the last people that needed to be saved, in a very crony and dishonest way, it just, some sort of light bulb went off in my head, and you know, my ego, you know, this was fortunate for me. My ego was sort of able to die a little bit. You know, I had a huge ego, obviously, at that point, right? Like, you're young, you're in New York, you think you're amazing, right? Because you're making a lot of money,
right,
and you're successful, and you think it's because you're so amazing. But what I realized with the bailouts was that the only reason I'm making money like this, and sure, I was good at my job, but the big picture reason was because the system is set up to enrich people doing that sort of a job. And at that point, it became a lot less interesting. And I sort of, you know, I felt like I didn't have anything else to prove anymore. And I felt dirty, you know, in the industry. And so I left, you know, I quit as soon as I got my bonus in January of 2010, literally the day it hit my bank account, I quit. And it was a great moment, but you know, it's been an interesting journey since, you know, 10 years. This January will be 10 years since I left. So, you know, that's the background on Wall Street.
Yeah, no, in reading, you know, we were talking off air, and I mean it earnestly and honestly. You know, we've had several guys on the show that have kind of that have been in the same similar place for me, meaning that you were one of the sources that I was reading on my own journey around that exact same time frame. Because I think that there's some of us, and I think you'd agree, it feels incredibly lonely, and I'm honestly shocked that more people haven't, you know, woken up and come more this way and opened their eyes and seen, you know, behind the curtain and seen really what's going on. But we were talking off air about how disillusioning, or you know, how it was just there was so much disillusion and I don't know, I wouldn't call it depression, but just, you know, shaking your head going, wait a second, this isn't what I thought it was. And then realizing what's really pulling the levers and what really matters, and that in a lot of ways this is no longer a free market. In a lot of ways they've cracked down on freedom in general. Anyway, so reading your stuff was part of my journey and part of my waking up and realizing that, you know, there is no there. That this is a charade. It's a shell of what it used to be. And so first of all, I applaud you for what you're doing and then speaking out and, you know, trying to educate people, which is something we do on this radio show, or we attempt to do. Obviously I manage money. I run an RIA. And so, you know, we talk a lot of finance, but trying to give our clients that background of really what's happening in the world. And so, you know, first and foremost, I just wanted to say thank you, because you've been one of those voices that's really helped clarify and bring, you know, focus to the things that were bothering me and pointing things out. And that's why I'd encourage everybody to go to your website, and get into your reading. So now fast forward, we moved to Colorado. You've had enough of the rat race. You've had enough of being part of the slum, the financial slum, as I refer to it. And you've essentially retired from markets, and you manage your own money now. I know that you're not horrifically involved in stock markets anymore, but you became very focused on gold and then Bitcoin. I'm assuming that's the proper order from reading your stuff. But tell us how that transition happened, because, again, it intrigues me, because, they, you know, I got very into gold as well right around the same time. Kind of tell me how you came to that realization and how that move started happening for you.
Okay. Yeah, so a few things. I mean, first, I just want to touch upon what you mentioned about your own journey, because every single person, and I know quite a few, right? A lot, actually, that has gone through something similar. And for most of us, you know, around a similar age, it's going to be the financial crisis that right. basically was when you first peered behind the curtain and said, oh, boy. You know, and so when you peer behind that, you either dig deeper and accept it and then go into a period of depression, or you just sort of say, oh, I don't want to look at that, and you forget about it, which right. a lot of people do as well. But, you know, for people like me and you who are just very curious, I'm assuming, you can't look the other way once you've seen it. You know, you've seen it. You can't forget it. And so there was, for me, a period of loneliness and depression, right, where I felt nobody understood me really, right? Very few people were writing about what I thought. The people that were tending to write about what I thought were big into gold, right? I think that's one of the things that happens. Yeah. The other is, of course, if you think at that time that, let's put it this way, let's rewind for a second. I mean, if you've been living up to 2008, if you'd been living on Earth for, let's say, 30 years or so and paid some attention to markets or worked in markets, you understood that, of course, there's the Fed. Of course, there's influences that manipulate markets. But there was always that. There was always a bit of freedom to them, right? There was always a bit of, like, chaos and stuff over the years. And so my assumption around 2008 and 2009 was that there would be at least some cleansing allowed, or at least, if not allowed, forced upon the market by economic nature. I was wrong about that, right, in the short term.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why I was wrong. The reason I was wrong is because I did not fully understand the country we live in. Right, as you said, I didn't understand that we don't have a democracy, we don't have a republic, we don't have a constitution anymore. I was naive in that sense. A lot of people knew that, but I did not. Right, I was too busy making money on Wall Street to actually thoughtfully think about what had happened in the prior 8 years of the 21st century post 9/11, when we lost so much freedom in a lot of ways. And so the more I started digging, the more I started realizing, well, okay, none of this is like I thought it was. You know, we really do live in very much what Sheldon Wolin calls an inverted totalitarianism.
Yep.
We have a totalitarian structure, an oligarchy, a feudalistic structure in a lot of ways. It's very much hidden. And those that, you know, sort of benefit from it certainly don't question it. And we continue to live in that. But the point being is, you know, this was the right way to think about 2008, 2009 at the time. You know, the U.S. government, right, the state, went to Iraq because they wanted to go to Iraq. They lied about it, right? Hundreds of thousands of people dead. Country is destroyed, and Iraq's just one example, right? So if the state is willing to do that, if the state is willing to sacrifice hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions across all of these wars, $6.4 trillion has been spent on the war on terror since 2001, if they're willing to do that, why wouldn't they be willing to do anything to markets? And that is what I did not appreciate at the time. And that's exactly what the last 10 years have shown me, is that the power structure in this country, right, is so invested in empire and financialization, that they view it as a war, right? So I think the Fed and the government, across administrations, views propping up assets, right, the asset bubble that we have, the biggest asset bubble in world history, especially with debt, they see it as a war. You know, they literally see it as a national security thing. And so if I had realized that the empire would throw every single thing it had, every lie, every cheat, every corruption at propping up assets, I probably would have seen things differently. But I didn't have that view of the country at that point. I did not have the accurate assessment of what we were really dealing with. And quite frankly, now I think it's pretty clear 10 years later, that is what we're dealing with.
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. I've described it before. It's sort of the merger of philosophy and finance, because you really we think that we're dealing with a spreadsheet world and a data driven world, you know, in terms of, you know, input this and this is the profit margin and this is what runs things. And then you realize, well, it plays a role, but it's a side role. It really is a side role. This is about power. This is about the creation of money. This is about positioning you and your corporation as close as you can to that spigot to that power, whether it's, you know, the senator or the Federal Reserve or what, you know, whatever it is. Maybe it's hiring a former Federal Reserve chairman to be on your board. It's the positioning of the power and the proximity to that spigot that has trumped everything. And right down to, like you said, you know, controlling markets and making the machine keep going. And you know, this whole idea that making markets rise, right, and suppressing volatility is good for, and it's good for the average investor. And he goes, oh, thank God the Federal Reserve jumped in. And it just infuriates me because I sit there and I go, look, I understand nobody wants to look at their account and see that they lost money, but volatility is your friend. Market crashes are what cleans out the muck. It's what pushes assets into the hands of other people, right? It even though you don't think it, if we suppress volatility, there is no turnover in terms of who has the assets, who has the money, and who has the power. And it's you know, that's this hijacking of public markets. And it's infuriating to me. And it's been going on for some time. And I think you've pointed that out, you know, that out so well. This is not new. But to me, I want to get into so many other topics, but I want to get your thoughts on this. I came to a realization when I was watching Noam Chomsky's Requiem for an American Dream, which, again, is strange. Me and Noam Chomsky are strange bedfellows. I grew up very much on the capitalist conservative side of things. In most ways, I still am, you know, much more on that side of things and that side of thinking. Although I have unidentified that with I don't think of myself as being Republican, right? I'm more libertarian. But I point back to, and I feel like so many people dance around this, but they don't get to the issue. To me, everything points back, and there's other factors, but the biggest thing that I see is everything points back to 1971. Everything points to when we went off the gold standard, government no longer had a report card. There was no way to hold them accountable. What are your thoughts on that? And do you see the similar thing? And we kind of walk me through your take on that.
Okay, sure. So first of all, yeah, like as far as Chomsky, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because, again, you know, people, this is what keeps people divided and unthinking. You know, so someone that, let's say, considers themselves a capitalist or a libertarian, whatever, you know, and they hear Chomsky or like read this by Chomsky, they'll say, oh, no, that guy's, you know, this crazy leftist. I'm not reading it.
Right.
And that's just so intellectually, you're being an intellectual midget because whether you concur with Chomsky's solutions or what he thinks needs to be done, the man is a brilliant describer of what we're in, you know, what we're living in. I mean, sometimes on YouTube, I'll listen to stuff from this guy, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago. I'm just like, man, yeah. People knew, you know, people knew a lot of this stuff, you know. It's been going on for a while. The national security state has been going on for a while. So I think you're asking about the gold standard. So I really think we need to see this, the whole thing, from a very big picture standpoint. And really, when the modern American empire is what we're dealing with, right?
Right.
And that empire flexes its muscles over the decades in different ways. Now, I would say the beginning of the end for the republic, right, or any semblance of self-government at all, happened immediately after World War II, with the creation of the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA. Once that happened, you really started, you got immediately what Eisenhower warned of, the military-industrial complex. And that was the beginning of the end. And so at that point, you know, American empire was exercised through strength, through actual strength, right? I mean, there was a gold standard. You know, the U.S. had almost the whole world's manufacturing base. It was the only place that wasn't bombed to smithereens. So the empire was there, right? It was born in earnest after World War II, but it really exercised power in a more conventional way. 1971 is where the U.S. empire figured out a way to exercise power without, in a non-traditional sense. In other words, via the fiat dollar. And that's what we've been living through ever since. So by not having to exercise empire through traditional means, right, actual wealth, actual, let's say, power, the dollar allowed financialization and banking to dominate the world. And it's a much lazier way of doing it, but it's, you know, it's a cheaper way, and it's a, and it's a very, very, what I like to say is the fiat U.S. dollar as reserve currency is the most powerful geopolitical weapon that's ever existed.
Yep.
And it continues to exist right to this day. But what that's also meant is a hollowing out of the rest of American society. Right. We've seen rapid growth in debt. We've seen rapid growth in financial oligarch power, financial services power. And we see now the ability to ruin countries just by using a dollar that's backed by nothing. Right. So that's where we're at right now. Right. I mean, it's been 50 years almost since the financial empire, right? The financialized empire really took hold. And, you know, my view is that by 2025, that financial empire will be in clear decline. But that's how I see it. So, yes, 71 was really important. But let's not think that, you know, the U.S. had already died in a lot of ways, right? The constitutional United States had already died in a lot of ways right after World War II.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. It was interesting to me. I totally agree with that timeline, and I think if you're a student of history, it's really hard to see it any other way. Obviously, I would entertain other ideas and listen to people with other opinions. But one of the things that frustrates me is that even listening to a guy like Chomsky, like I said, strange bedfellow, but if you listen to that, if you watch that documentary, he dances all around it, and he never addresses it. He points to all these things around 1971 and late 60s, even talks about post-World War II. But I love the way you set that up. The ball was already in motion, right? It was beginning to roll. And I feel like, or the way that I view it is 71 was the gloves coming off. It was, you know, here we are in all of our grand splendor, and we're not even going to fake it anymore. We're going to tell you there's nothing backing it. And the beautiful thing about that is it removes the control. It removes the constraints. I've tried to explain it to people. Look, if you still had a gold standard, do you think we would have fought as many wars? You know, no, there's no, we wouldn't have been able to afford it, right? There would have been constraints. Think how many lives have been lost due to just go, like you said, the ball was in motion, but just going off the gold standard. Anyway, it's perplexing to me. Now I want to get to your thoughts on gold and how you got there, because obviously all of this points to, you know, the need or obviously in our opinion, the need for some type of, you know, not an asset that can't be controlled by government, an asset that holds people accountable. How did that exploration or that move into gold happen with you?
Yes. Okay. So a few things, and I'm going to put Bitcoin in here too, because I'm as big of a proponent of Bitcoin, probably even more so than gold for a variety of reasons we can get into if you'd like at this point. But I am, you know, if people ask me, what should they be owning? You know, I would say, you know, you should have some USD, because you need to live, and assets like Bitcoin and gold can be volatile. But other than that, you know, I had some Bitcoin, some gold, and some US dollars. I mean, that's how I am, right?
Yeah.
But look, with gold, the reason I first got into it, right, and explored it is because, you know, it's pretty simple. You know, when you look at the debt, and you look at how this thing can play out over, you know, any sort of long period of time, it becomes very clear that, you know, what I like to say recently is populism is inflationary. We're going to the idea. Look, who has a lot of the debt? Millennials, right?
Yep.
Who's now the largest generation in America? Millennials. How are they going to vote? Right? I mean, you're already starting to see it with stuff like MMT becoming more popular and Green New Deal and all this stuff. I mean, there's no way, in my view, that this doesn't get resolved via just some sort of debt jubilee. And in that kind of an environment, you know, gold is an asset you want to hold. If you have physical gold, obviously there's no counterparty risk, which is very important, you know, in today's financial world. And it's sort of just the reset asset. And don't forget, I mean, you know, I got quiet on gold for a while after, you know, I realized, you know, sort of like what we discussed before, when I realized that the entire American empire was 100% dedicated to keeping the financial bubble alive, that's when I realized, okay, well, we need to take a step back here. You know, they've won for now, right?
Yes.
This cycle. And that was, let's say, 2011 to 2011, October 2011, September, was the high in gold. And then I started getting more bullish publicly last September-ish because, you know, well, it was 7 years, right? It was a nice cycle for me. But also I started looking geopolitically, things changing. And as China and the U.S. tensions continue to increase, you know, central banks and governments are going to play in gold. I mean, that's really where they are. When, you know, a lot of the gold bug rhetoric over the last, let's say post-financial crisis, was that everyone was going to buy physical gold and, you know, fund managers were going to buy it and there was going to be, you know, there wasn't going to be enough physical and the price would explode. Well, it never happened, right?
Right.
And part of the reason it never happened is because the system is set up for that not to happen. You know, you're not. What happens if, like, large asset managers all of a sudden call London and say, I want, you know, 1,000 tons of gold right now? You know, what do they get threatened? I'm sure they do. You know, so it's sort of disallowed, in a sense, from the current financial system, the way it's structured. You know, just that's how the empire runs. But once you start having geopolitical tensions, legitimate, like, nation-state superpower versus nation-state superpower kind of thing, that's where I think, you know, you can have the real run on gold. And so I think that's partly why, that's an addition, that's something that did not exist, let's say, from 2011 to 2018, but in my opinion will exist from 2020 to 2025. So when people ask, well, what's the difference? We had QE during that period, right? We had a debt bubble during that period. We had all these things during that period, but gold didn't do well. I think the factor that will push it over the top is not just a more pronounced failure in the global macro system, which I do think will happen in the next 5 years, but also the geopolitical battle, which I think is just getting warmed up. So that's gold, right? As far as Bitcoin, I mean, we talked about getting into the depression hole, the depression rabbit hole, after you sort of admit to yourself how things run. I have to say, I was depressed about the future of the world until I learned about Bitcoin. That was literally the turning point for me. And the reason is because once I discovered it, I said, okay, now I can see a way forward. Because up until that point, it just looked like eventual collapse and gold might do well, but society would look terrible. But when I saw that Bitcoin existed, I knew that something different could exist. I knew that people were working on the geniuses, right? The geniuses, essentially, were behind the scenes thinking very thoughtfully about a subversive way to stick it to the system, essentially. And Bitcoin is that even more than gold. And if you want to discuss that at all, we can. But yes, I do think the advent of Bitcoin is like one of the most important moments of my life, learning about it and getting into it.
Yeah, I have complex and mixed feelings about Bitcoin, and I actually have it on my list to talk with you about it because I was one of the first fans of Bitcoin of anybody that I know. As a matter of fact, I remember sitting in my office the day that it was launched. And the reason it caught my eye is because I was in the middle of the deluge. I was in the middle of the depression, sitting there realizing that they can just print and print and print, and they can override. You know, they can make markets not be markets again. They have nothing constraining them. And then Bitcoin was launched, and I heard an explanation of it. And I still remember. I have an uncle of mine who's like an older brother, kind of a mentor. And he ran a management firm. And I called him, and I just said, "Look at this. This is a shot across the bow of fiat currency," and I had no money at the time. I was just starting out, but I remember sitting there thinking to myself, this is something you throw some cash out as a lottery ticket. And I think, Mike, I mean, I get depressed talking about it, but I think it was like at $1 or $2 at that point or something like that. Now, but I will say, and my biggest reservation today, people go, oh, you're not a Bitcoiner, you're a no-coiner. And I said, no. I think Bitcoin is revolutionary. I think it's one of the most democratic things I've ever seen launched. And that is precisely what scares me, because I am not, even though I detest the way that the system is currently set up, and I recognize all the things you see or that you're talking about, I also sit there through personal experience and go, You know, you might hate it. You might think these people are evil. You might think all these different things, but don't underestimate their power. And to me, you know, I look at Bitcoins. We live in a central bank dominated world. And the biggest threat that I see to central banks by far is Bitcoin. And that is precisely what concerns me. I sit there and I go, look, are these guys going to allow this? And I don't know enough, Mike. And I was looking forward to talking to you about it, because that to me is the only thing that is preventing me. And I explain to people, I go, no, it is because I think Bitcoin is so good that I'm worried about it. It's not that I'm one of those guys, oh, it's worthless. But I think it's so good and so democratic that is the real threat to its existence. How did you work through that? I know you're a very thoughtful guy. I know for a fact this isn't the first time you've heard this. How did you rationalize that, and where did you go? You know, walk me through your process of how you confronted that aspect of Bitcoin.
Okay, gosh, there's so many angles to take this from, and I'm going to try. Hopefully, I can remember a lot of them. But let's take big picture. Okay, there's two things I believe that at moments of history that we're at, you need to take account of. First of all, in the last 10 years, our lesson in this: do not underestimate the enemy. Right. In other words, like the state.
Yes.
Or if you consider the centralized oppressive state an enemy, which I do, do not underestimate it. Right. Obviously, do not underestimate the empire. The empire is willing to kill millions, maybe billions, right, to maintain control. I mean, this is a proven fact, so don't underestimate them. That's for sure. At the same time, what history also shows you is that empires always fall, that the powerful rise and the powerful fall, and hubris, arrogance, stepping forward too much are telltale signs that, you know, that power structure is going to fall. Now, you see all of that very, very present in the U.S. empire today. It's all over the place. But the other thing is this. What else causes power structures to weaken and fall? Technology.
Yeah.
Right? Some sort of asymmetric weapon that didn't exist before, that the current structure doesn't know how to handle or can't handle or dismisses too long and misses the window. And I think Bitcoin is one of those things. And I think that's how you have to look at it. So then there's the other thing, right? So let's talk. That's just my big picture view, right? That Bitcoin is a very powerful technological tool that is hard to confront by the state and probably has the best chance, as you said, of anything to make a profound difference. Okay, so if we agree with that, which you do agree
yep.
with that,
yep.
You should support it. So that's number one. So in other words, that doesn't mean you have to buy it or you have to buy a lot of it, but it means you should support it. It means you should vocally support it. It means you should always say that. So in other words, you could say, well, I'm hesitant to buy it, but this is great. Like, I hope it does well. You know, you should always be on the side of those in the Bitcoin, with Bitcoin skin in the game. Because at the end of the day, as you said, this is a tool of the people. I mean, it is. It's a tool of decentralization. It shows, not only does it do it to money, though, and this is what I try to tell people, it shows us a new way forward in general. In other words, let's think of some of the key attributes of Bitcoin. Decentralization. There's no one in charge. There's no Bitcoin CEO. There's no Bitcoin company. There's no one to call and say, hey, by the way, you know, I'm sure you like those kids you have. You know, you better get out of Bitcoin there's no one to threaten.
There's no one to be corrupted.
Right. There's no central point to push to get what you want, which anything that has that, the empire can push and scare, and it's over, right?
Yep.
Look what happened when Epstein was ready to potentially cause problems for the centralized empire, right? He's gone, right? In a second, he's gone. So they can do that, right? We know that they can do that. Bitcoin, because of its nature, intentional nature of distributing how it works across machines around the world, and nodes around the world, makes that impossible. So that's number one. So we should think about power in general that way, not just money, but in general. Like, we need to distribute power more. It shouldn't all be in Washington, D.C. It shouldn't be concentrated in New York finance. It should be spread out. Okay, so that's a lesson it gives us. Another is permissionlessness, okay? So, you know, you can send some Bitcoin from one place to another without asking anyone's permission. Nobody can stop you. That's powerful. Now, in certain things, you need that. You know, that's freedom, okay? It's a tool. Yes, people will say, oh, but you can use it for this, but you can use it for that. But that's the case with anything.
Yep.
Right? Unless you want to start doing pre-crime, you can't automatically assume that someone is doing something bad just because they're using a tool. So it teaches us to think about stuff like that more thoughtfully, not just with money, but with speech. Because now all the rage is, oh, well, hate speech, and, you know, we don't like this, and Twitter arbitrarily banning people, and Facebook doing the same. It's, you know, we have to get back to basic civil liberties, which is the freedom to engage in things like communication or money spending without the state telling you can do it ahead of time, okay? Because otherwise we're just slaves on a plantation. So that's another thing Bitcoin shows. So and then, of course, you know, it's a way, you know, it's just a protocol. Right, it's just code, and that's the last one, the open source nature of the code. We have no idea what the heck Google is doing in the background of YouTube or its search. They're constantly changing it. They're constantly manipulating you. They're constantly nudging you with their algorithms, but we don't know because they don't show us the code. We don't know the code for Facebook. How are they doing what they do? Why are they doing it? Same with Twitter. This is crazy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, to rely on communications platforms and the internet based on tech giants that control secret code for profit is a really, really stupid way to move forward. So Bitcoin shows us with its open source code that's a way you've got to do things like this. You know, if you want we need to see what's fair. We need transparency, because transparency is the enemy of centralized authoritarian power. So we should be pushing for that in all aspects. Of particularly in big things like communications and money. Transparency. What is the code? How does it work? Anyone can look at it. So those are three things: permissionlessness, decentralized, and open source. Okay, and those things, in my opinion, if we have a good future, right, if the next 20 years is a bright 20 years for humanity, and we can get towards a new renaissance for the species, I think those three things are going to be very, very important. So that's just the philosophical case for why Bitcoin matters, not just for money, but for, I would say, human civilization going forward in general. So I think you agree with all of that.
Yes. Okay?
So the next thing is, are you still there, Zach? I just want to make sure.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
Okay, as I'm talking a lot.
Yeah, no,
okay,
it's all right.
So the next thing is, okay, do you throw money at it? Do you invest in it? What I always said from the beginning, when it was $10, is I say put 1% of your worth in it. Right, you look at it like a call option with no expiration date. Bitcoin's going to go to 100,000 in the next 2 or 3 years, or it could go to zero. So invest accordingly. But I think the problem is people don't see Bitcoin in that way, and they should. You don't have to make a big bet. What's going to happen to you if you put 2% of your personal net worth into Bitcoin and it goes to zero? Are you going to be ruined? Of course not. But what happens if that goes 10x in the next 2 or 3 years? Well, you've got an amazing gain for very little at risk. And like I said, the option doesn't expire unless the whole thing, you know, dies, which is unlikely. So that's how I see it. You know, I think too many people want to make sure that they're right about it. You know, that to say, okay, well, I'm long some Bitcoin, and then they need to be confident that they're going to be right to do that. But that's silly. I think that what people should say, assuming that they believe it's a force for good, which I do, if they believe that, you say, okay, I'll throw a little bit of money at it, and I'm going to support it, and if it doesn't work out well, oh well. You know, but yes, you shouldn't put a huge, you know, I am overinvested in it for sure. That's a function of, you know, buying it really low and it going up a lot. But, you know, so I wouldn't recommend my allocation, you know, but I would say, you know, to just anyone, what's the problem with putting 1 or 2%? You know, what is the worst that can happen to you? You lose 1 or 2%.
Yeah, that's a bad day in the market. Now, Mike, and I do agree with your take on it. The biggest and funny enough, that's the advice that we've given our clients. You know, just you won 1.5% of the portfolio up to 2, keep it there, and we'll play it by ear. But now on a philosophical, again, I'm with you 100%. But regarding that issue of when the central banks attack and you know, if people are listening, they go, you know, these guys are conspiratorial. The world is literally being controlled. Finances, wealth is being made and lost, all based on the power of central bankers and their infinite wisdom to conjure capital out of thin air. If you don't think that they're going to launch a counterstrike against Bitcoin at some point, and I know you do, I'm not speaking this to you, you know, I don't think that you're being intellectually honest. What defenses did, how will Bitcoin hold up when that focus gets put on it, when the guns are leveled at Bitcoin, how does it defend? I that's the one thing. Can't government just get in there somehow? And again, I don't understand the technology of it well enough, but can't they stop it? Can't they get in there and corrupt the code? I mean, what is Bitcoin's defense?
Well, okay, so I think there's a lot of pieces to that. And again, I'm going to try to remember all of the thoughts I have. First of all, and I think this is overlooked, is I don't think it's likely that every central bank is going to simultaneously try to attack Bitcoin. Okay, and that matters. And it matters because in the geopolitical world we're going into, in which I see superpower conflict, like serious superpower conflict, I think that currency, right, financial markets and currency is going to play a big role, more so than bombs. That's what I've said for a while. Like, less bombs and missiles, more currency cyber. And so let's say that's true. And let's say I'm also correct that the most powerful weapon of the United States empire is the U.S. dollar. Okay? So if that's the case, then would competing superpowers really want to attack Bitcoin and end it? Wouldn't it actually be sort of an escape valve to pressure the dollar? I mean, couldn't China and Iran say, "Hey, you know what? You know, send me some oil and we'll settle it with Bitcoin." I mean, could that happen? I feel like, a lot of times you have to remember that elites like certain assets that you'd think they wouldn't like to exist just for their own benefit.
Yeah.
You know, so corrupt people, right, in other countries or whatever, could find Bitcoin useful. I think that's rightly, just like tax havens have been useful, just like gold, right, is in that sense useful. So I think that you have to take a step back and understand that there are lots of competing interests and there are a lot of competing powers out there. And I think over time, a lot of those powers are going to say, well, you know what, actually, the fact that Bitcoin exists, it might be helpful. You know, might be useful, particularly if fiat currencies are sort of going to get wrecked anyway. You know, elites in certain countries are going to want to get their money out, right? I mean, they're going to want protection.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that Bitcoin actually offers that protection, even for, just like it offers freedom for humanity in general, it also offers protection for some bad guys, right? For getting money out. And I think, ironically enough, I think that could actually end up protecting it in a way, right? So in other words, you will have pushback, but it may not be as coordinated and global as you might assume.
Well, and that's a great point, and I haven't thought about it from that angle, because one of the hallmarks, I'm sure you've done the same thing, but my wife can speak to this. You know, part of the evolution that I was on, a lot of it, there were countless hours just me leaning back in the chair or in a dry, you know, working on a dry erase board by myself, trying to understand how this new world looked, and really, like I said, I'd pulled back the curtain, and there was just so much time processing and thinking about it. And one of the greatest weapons or tools that I saw was not only the conjuring of capital out of thin air, but it was also the coordination. And I remember thinking to myself, coming to the realization that the sign or a signpost to look for will be a breakdown in coordination. When this coordinated effort to by central banks, when it starts becoming competitive. And I had not applied that to Bitcoin, but that is sort of what we're seeing, aren't we? The competitive aspects of this central game, the central bank game, they're really starting to heat up.
Right. That's right. And I want to get into another angle as well. But so that's correct. So if you start to think about the global order, right? If you agree with my premise that the global order, geopolitically and economically, is fraying at the moment, right? I mean, that from 2011 to 2018, for the most part, you know, everyone, China, the U.S., we're all trying to sort of put Humpty Dumpty back together again and benefit from it. But that's changed, you know, in the last year or so since Trump, and probably it's going to continue to change, even if Trump's not the next president. I think it's sort of that ship has sailed. Look at bipartisan bills that are being signed in Congress related to Hong Kong. If you believe that, we're headed for, again, like we're in this Thucydides trap, in which great power conflict is on the horizon. Does Bitcoin play a role, right? I mean, is that an asset that plays a role in the various, let's say, countries and competing interests going to battle with one another? You know, does that play a role? And I do think it does, you know, and so that's why I sort of feel like it'll stick around. And I think it will be in the interests of certain powerful people to actually keep it going. But there's another thing, and this is really important. And this is why I think Bitcoin is stronger than gold under pressure of government. Okay, gold kind of is a movement, right? I mean, there you know, like there's the gold bugs and whatever, right? But guess what, right? There's two things about those, you know, and I know that community very well, okay? There's two things about them. One, they're old, right? They're older men, generally.
Yep.
And two, because of the nature of gold, and this is a don't get me wrong, this is a huge positive to gold, right? Why it's lasted for thousands of years. It doesn't do anything, right? It doesn't change. You can't devote yourself to gold, right? Other than buying it and talking about it.
Right.
Bitcoin is completely different. And so therefore it attracts a younger, tech savvy segment of the population. And there's things to do with it. Okay, you can run a node. You build products around it, whether it's an exchange or a hardware wallet. I mean, it's infinite, right? Sort of the things you can build on top of Bitcoin. So it's an extremely creative and dynamic space, as opposed to gold, which is a completely static old person space. Therefore, it plays into this sort of generational divide that's going on, and that's only going to get worse. Like, okay, boomer, right? That's a big part of it, right? You see, it's a way to sort of say, just shut up already. You know, you old people, you ruined everything, right?
Right.
Whether you believe that or not, that's what that means. And so Bitcoin is part of that. And so therefore, it's part of a bigger thing. It's part of a generational movement, and it actually is a social, global, worldwide movement. And I've seen this before. A lot. And are they kidding? Are they tongue-in-cheek? How many of them are serious? But I've seen, like, Bitcoiners, and not that infrequently, say they would die for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Who's going to die for gold? Right? No, nobody. Nobody. Are there young people that, if push came to shove, would be willing to sacrifice, to put it all on the line to defend this protocol? I believe that there are. And I believe that every single day that passes, there are more people in that camp, not less. And for me, to really have done damage to Bitcoin, you would have had to do it in its infancy. And that didn't happen. And so now you've got a global movement centered on the young, not just the young, though, some of the smartest, most capable young people in the world are very invested. And as you know, I'm sure, well, I mean, I don't know how much you're into the culture or know it, but I know it pretty well. You know, these people live and breathe Bitcoin.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
Right. Right. It's a real thing. That's why people call it a religion. I used to say that the closest chart that I could see to charting Bitcoin would be the chart of the rise of Christianity.
Yeah.
It's similar in that sense to me, right? Like, okay, what would you have said? You would have probably said the exact same thing in the early days of Christianity, right? You would have said, well, Rome will crush it. But look what happened, right? Rome got crushed, and what's still around? Right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you get, now is Bitcoin that, right? Is it really that big? I don't know, but it could be. Right, it could be, and the people that are dedicated to it have a religious fervor to it that you don't see. Most of the people that own gold, it's very different, right? Because I know both communities. Most of the people that own gold are like, well, yeah, you know, they're sort of rooting for collapse in a way, which is unfortunate, right? You don't want to live that way. It's a very depressing way to live. But a lot of people that are dedicated on Bitcoin are like, no, we're creating the future. You know,
yeah.
And when someone feels like they're creating the future, and then the government comes in to stop it or ruin them or ruin what their life's passion is that person, is that community going to sit down, lie down and take it? you know, no, I don't think so. And so here's the thing, right? You said, what's going to happen when the state really comes down on it, right? Like, and believe me, I agree that at some point, probably in the next few years, probably after it crosses 100,000, that will happen in some way, in some more serious way. So that is a given, right? So I agree that's coming, but that's part of the dance, right? That's part of the game. Like, you don't start, even with civil disobedience, right? Like, I mean, the civil rights movement, right? The people that got involved in that knew that some of them were going to die. You know, they knew that some of them were going to get their heads cracked in, right? That was part of the understanding of resistance. You know, it's nothing comes free. And so to me, we don't know how that's going to play, right? We do agree that there's going to be more tension, that there's going to be probably some moment of friction. But I'm not convinced at all that the state wins that. I'm really not, because and a big reason for that is because there is a very big youth-focused or powerful, let's say, movement around Bitcoin. And I think that does play a huge role. So what I would say is, look, have a little bit, own a little bit, sit back, understand the risks, understand that it could be a zero, understand that there's a good chance it goes to 100K in the next 2-3 years, and then just watch the game. But when the game unfolds, right, if you have a little bit of skin in the game, and this is why I like the idea of having some, because let's say you have 2% of your assets in it, and let's say then it goes to 100,000, and then the state comes in to try to crush you. You've got some skin in the game now, right? You're going to really be supportive. You're going to really, but it still was only 2% that you put in. And so that's good. I want you to be in the game a little bit. You know, I want you to care when the state comes for you. But look, there's other things as well, which, you know, you can't dismiss. Like the Georgia, I mean, they just appointed it. Or, you know who's going to be the new senator of Georgia? Are you familiar with the Bakkt exchange at all?
Yeah, a little bit.
Intercontinental, yeah. It's like that new Bitcoin exchange, right?
Yep.
The CEO of that is going to be the senator from Georgia.
Wow.
Next year.
Wow.
Now, again, this lady was not elected. She was appointed by the governor, but still, can you imagine that? If someone told you that a sitting U.S. senator, right, was just the CEO of a major Bitcoin exchange 5 years ago, you would have laughed at that, right?
Probably.
And so look, things can change in a very non-conventional way, and I think you have to think that, and particularly in the times that we're in. And I'd also just like to end it with this: like when I first got involved at around $10. Everyone said the exact same thing. So this whole, like, oh, the government's going to crush it, by the way, that's been said for 9 years already.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, again, it's not to say that there's not a fight that's going to be had. But trust me, this has been said for 9 years. I've heard it for 9 years.
Well, and one of the things that honestly has been picking at the back of my brain was they haven't yet. So what that tells me, or what that leads me to believe, is that it has to go higher to get their attention, which I don't see not happening, right? I think it at least has to get to a level where the guns do get leveled and on it. And you know, before the, you know, if they can destroy it or they can crimp it down, it has to go higher because it hasn't been attacked yet. And that's the beauty of having a deflationary asset like Bitcoin is just, you know, over time, just through adoption, it has to go up, right?
Yeah. And also, are you familiar with the Bitcoin halving at all?
Halving? No, no.
We should go over that if not.
Go hit it.
Okay, so this has been a cycle, and you can look at it, right? Like, a lot of people, the thing I always laugh is, like, when traditional finance people show a chart of Bitcoin, like, oh, it's a classic bubble. You know how many classic bubbles Bitcoin's had? It's had, like, three before the last one.
Right,
you know,
right.
It keeps hitting new highs. That means it's not really a bubble, right? A real bubble crashes and doesn't go right back to a new high, 10x higher in 3 years. Right? That's not a bubble.
Yeah, that's not what tulips did.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That's like sort of like what probably Christianity did. It's a different thing entirely, and so a lot of the cycles around the price moves have to do with this event called the halving, which happens every 4 years, or the halving, and that's just baked into the protocol of Bitcoin, which is that every 4 years, roughly, the supply of Bitcoin that's mined, right, because every 10 minutes, a certain amount of Bitcoin gets mined, and I believe right now it's 12.5. every 10 minutes.
Okay.
But in May of 2020, that number is going to get cut in half to 6.25. I think I have my numbers right, but it will get cut in half, right, from something to another thing. And that's happened two times before in Bitcoin's history. It happened in around November 2012, and it happened in June, I believe, 2016. Go ahead and look at the chart patterns of Bitcoin around the halvenings, what happens. What tends to happen, at least, and I've lived through both of these, you know, trading it, watching it, all of that, is that you get a giant run after that event, which does make sense because all of a sudden the amount that is being produced, right, the new coins being produced, gets cut in half forever from that point forward. So if the price stays the same, you can have some problems. So the price tends to rise, you know, and if demand is, and you mentioned adoption, so if the adoption is increasing and the supply that's being created is decreasing, what usually will happen to price, all things equal? And that is what's happened in the past. So I would just say, you know, so far this cycle, right, post like the 19,000 in December 2017 to now, has felt very much just like the popping that we saw in 2013, where we went from about 1,200 to back to 150. And then we went from 150 to 19,000. But I've seen a lot. Like I said, I was in at 10. I saw it go from 10 to 120, back to 50, to 1,200, right? To 150, to 20,000, you know? And now back to, it got down to 3,000. This cycle has been repeated many times. And the halving is coming up in May 2020. So, again, there's no guarantees. But when you factor everything together, and you look at the history and the cycles as it's worked before, and you're assuming that you're going to get another wave of adoption or demand even stays the same, you know, the odds of you doing pretty well over the next 2 to 3 years is pretty good. You know, nothing's guaranteed, but no one's telling you to put a huge chunk of money in it either. So something to be aware of for those people who like to sort of know the fundamentals of supply, at least the supply side of Bitcoin.
Well, and the other thing too, it is one of the reasons why I want to talk to you and have you on, was because you have to put, and I preach this to our clients all the time, that no asset exists in a vacuum, and it's all about relative value. And you may say these things about Bitcoin, and I'm kind of talking myself through it right now. You may have your critiques, but at the same time, let's also go look at what type of faith investments you've currently got in your portfolio as it is, right? Look at the valuation of the average stock, or the fact that, you know, so many retirees are still 30 or 40% in bonds, you know, given the current structure of the interest rates and all these other kind of things, that you have so much faith built into your current investment thesis on valuation, on the ridiculous debt loads, on all these things that you and I know that are just, that are laughable, you know, to get into, and I know this isn't what you're focused on now, but, you know, you get into the stock market, and I chuckle every time I hear somebody say stocks aren't overvalued, and I'm like sitting there going, on what universe are you valuing these things? Because they are, in any measurable way, they are. And there's a tremendous amount of faith that this time is different, and yet at all the same time, we turn this skeptical eye to Bitcoin, and to some degree, I'm guilty of that too. You know, just there's so much faith, right? And then we won't extend it in this certain area. So anyway, Mike, it's been fascinating to talk, and I can't tell you thank you enough for coming on. And are there any closing thoughts? Are there any other things that if you're sitting there talking, because our audience is, somewhat financially savvy, but, you know, probably mirror me to some degree, that we are a bit, you know, neophytes as far as it relates to Bitcoin. Are there any other key things that you want to leave us with that you would tell Bitcoin neophytes to focus on?
Okay. Yeah. And I'm not going to focus financially here because I think we covered what the assets I really like.
Right.
I would just say this. The next 5 years, in my opinion, are going to be the most transformative, chaotic, interesting, scary, dynamic you've lived through, right?
Yep.
And I'm sure a lot of, you know, your listeners are familiar with the concepts of the fourth turning and generational cycles, but I think it's beyond that even. I mean, I think we're potentially towards the end of a bigger cycle than that. I mean, like, not just the 80-year cycle, but maybe a 500-year cycle. I mean, I genuinely think that the world is going to change so much in the next 5 years, everything about it. You know, the fundamental firmament, right? The structure, the paradigm that has dominated the planet for our entire lives, right? Like since World War II, is going to be flipped, and I don't know how that's going to shake out. Nobody does, but I will say that I think the smartest thing you can do is pay attention to the signs. You know, like Bitcoin was a sign that things are getting interesting in a weird way in that sense. You know, a lot of people dismissed it, but it was important. Whether or not it ends up being as important as I think, it's certainly been important. It's been the best investment anyone could have ever made, right, over the last 10 years.
Yeah. No.
So there's more going to be more of that. You know, the internet needs to be, in my opinion, completely redone. I mean, it's completely messed up. I think the big theme, and this could be wishful thinking, I will admit that, because this is the optimist in me speaking, but I think the biggest change is going to be, we've been for decades, since the 70s, but also since World War II, we've been centralizing. Everything's been centralized. Government's been centralized. Corporate power's been centralized. Financial systems have been centralized. Everything has been getting into smaller and smaller pockets of power concentrated in certain areas. And I think the revolution that we're going to see, and again, this is the revolution I want to see, as well.
So you and me both.
Wishful thinking, yeah. Is decentralization of things. I think as the centralized systems fail, and as people realize that they're not working for them, we're going to disperse power. We're going to see cities. We could even see the emergence of city states on a geopolitical level, where localism, I think that's a term that people should start thinking about. I think localism is going to become a big thing, where people, it's not just buying local, but, you know, even looking to govern more local. I think the move to, let's say, legalize cannabis in certain states like yours and mine, it was by referendum in Colorado. I think it was in Washington as well.
Yep.
But you know, a decade before, you know, Washington D.C. ever does anything. That's the sort of thing I think is going to happen going forward as well. And that's part of the decentralization trend. It's saying, okay, Washington D.C. is worthless. It's corrupt. We got to take charge of how we want our world to be structured, and we got to do it at the local level. And so it's, you know, so Bitcoin was one of the shots across the bow in that sense, right? It was this sort of move towards rejecting centralization of money, towards decentralizing money. But I think that's going to play out in a lot of different areas. So just think about life in general. Like, what is too centralized? What will be less centralized? Should it be less centralized? Stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate it, man. It's been great to chat with you and challenge my own thoughts. And like I said, it's been something that has just been, you know, gnawing at my brain for quite some time, because I am such a supporter of the idea and decentralization and localization. I mean, you're preaching to the choir, Mike. And I can't thank you enough for doing it and also challenging some of our ideas. And, you know, we live in a brave new world, and I hope it gets more brave, and I hope it gets more new. But it really is going to challenge us to think outside of the box, and I that's what you've done here today. And can't thank you for having coming on, and can't thank you enough for being with us today. And you know, if you're willing, I'd like to check in with you from time to time and kind of see how things are going. Hopefully, you'll give us some updates and discuss new happenings in the world of Bitcoin.
Oh, sure, Zach. Absolutely. You know, I think the Bitcoin world is going to start to get exciting sometime early, first or second quarter next year. So we'll see as far as price, but it's always exciting.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, it was great to be on. I appreciate it, and I'd be happy to talk to you in the future.
All right. Well, that was Mike Krieger of LibertyBlitz.com. I suggest you check out his website. Follow him at LibertyBlitz or at LibertyBlitz on Twitter, and then libertyblitzkrieg.com. You can read his stuff on, which I'd highly suggest, read his stuff on Zero Hedge. Mike, thanks again for being with us, and go take care of that sick little girl of yours, and have a wonderful weekend.
Okay, will do. Thank you. You too.
All right. Okay, that's it for today's show, you guys. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, we'll be back next week, but we'll talk to you soon. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.